Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierka with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Wednesday, March the 25th, 2026, and this is episode 3823 of the Survival Podcast, and it is time for an expert panel Q&A show for the week. Now, wait a minute. It's Wednesday. Wednesday's supposed to be interview day, right? Not expert panel day. Jack's supposed to be live streaming this show and then publishing it as a audio podcast later on. That's the way it's supposed to work. It's not going to work that way today. It's not a mistake. I announced it at the end of the show yesterday, but Mike Melito, who you will hear from today during today's show, from Good Shepherd Training, is actually going to be on the show with an interview tomorrow, and he was just unable to make a Wednesday work, which is normal interview day, so we modified this week and agreed to accommodate him on a Thursday to accommodate his schedule, because while he's been on the show a lot as an expert panel member, he's one of the few expert panel members who has never actually been on the show for a standalone interview. In fact, he might be the only one who's never been on the show for a standalone interview, certainly of the currently serving. So with that, we will have him tomorrow. And it should be a great interview. We'll be talking, of course, about guns, gun training, and other cool tactical stuff like that. But what do we got lined up for you today? Well, Dan McAdams and Ron Paul from the Liberty Report highlights of the week, and Chris was able to get us one over early this week to accommodate our change. I'm going to answer a question. Is Trump about to put thousands of American troops' lives on the line with an escalation in the Iran conflict? I haven't heard that one yet. We'll listen together. I was actually going to talk about what I think is going to happen next in my anchor segment today, but given this, I'll just say a little bit on it there, and we'll see over the weekend if it moves along as quickly as I think it might. Joel Riles is going to talk about choosing a breed of dogs for hunting, and he mentions my favorite breed there, the Brittany, but I'm sure when I hear all of his segment, I might have a little add on that one. Ryan Stiefel will talk about using a power station for backup for freezers when you're away from home. You have somebody watching your house. Normally, you just fire up the generator. That person may not be able to do it, and you got thousands of dollars worth of meat and other things in there. Yeah, it's something you probably want an always instant on backup for. Jesse Markowitz will talk about running down a checklist for running a Bitcoin node on Start 9, and also kind of like, what's the advantage? What do you get out of running a Bitcoin node yourself? Michael Melito, like I said, he'll be on today and he'll be on tomorrow. But today we're going to be talking about red dot magnifiers. Are they worth having? And if so, when are they worth it? Like, what is the situation where you go with a red dot with a magnifier versus a low magnification scope? Or just a red dot without the magnifier? When do you do that and why would you do that? Matt Sersley is going to answer a question on, this is for a microgreens grower. It's basically saying, should I file a Schedule F or should I file a Schedule C? And this is a big it depends, and I have one it depends. I'll re-listen as I put the show together for you today, but I don't think Matt brought this one up. And it's not really a tax issue. It is a future credit line issue that may be something you want to consider if you plan on trying to get a farm loan in the future, an ag loan in the future. It's something I think that might fly under Matt's radar a little bit. But we'll see, because I didn't listen to the whole segment. And then I got an email. I hadn't had an email like this one in a while, like where I go, I smell Alex Jones in there, right? This is a question about, I have all these preps, but if the shit hits the fan, the .gov is going to come steal my preps and give them to my neighbors or take them for themselves or something like that. I'm going to tell you why that is a worry that you put in the 99% I am not worried about it category. I didn't say 100%, but I said 99%. And if I'm being honest, it's more like 99.8. It's like a 0.2% worry factor, let alone probability factor. But we'll talk about some things you can do to mitigate the potential anyway so that you feel better the next time somebody on the radio or YouTube tells you they're going to come take it all from you. Just like the zombies are going to steal your tomatoes, so why would you grow a garden? Anyway, we'll handle that when we get there. It's one of the talk them off the ledge questions that after 18 years. I don't get many of them anymore, but new people show up all the time. I'm guessing that's where this is coming from. Before we get into it, though, and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams, I want to let you guys know about my item of the day for today, rounding out this week somewhat. I just happened to get a price alert today. The Victorinox 6-inch semi-stiff boning knife. And yes, I know some of you juvenile children, David, you're out there giggling right now. He said semi-stiff boning. Yeah, okay. Anyway, that's what it's called, man. This is one of the best knives you will ever own. It is not expensive. It's on sale today. It's under $30. It is the number one knife used by professional meat cutters in the country, possibly the world. I don't know that, so I can't say the world, but I know the country. Like when I went up to a beef processing workshop with Sean up at Country Mama Farms last year with my grandson, he had a box full of these things. This was the number, like there's some bigger breaking knives and stuff they use at different parts, but you know, for the overall use, this knife got more use for trimming, for deboning, for things like that, anything else. If you buy and part out your own chickens, or you're smart enough to know, don't buy the boneless, skinless chicken thighs. Buy the ones that cost, 30% of the cost. Do that yourself and use the trimmings to make stock or whatever. You want this knife. This will be one of those knives, until you own one, you won't realize how great it is, and I'm just warning you, one detrimental thing. When you buy one, you'll use it for a couple of weeks, you will buy a second one, minimum. Just so in between time when you're sharpening, like I just pick the other one up and I'll sharpen them both at the end of the week or whatever. It is just that fantastic of a value for what it is. I own some extremely expensive knives, and not just knives that are carry knives or display knives. I mean, I own some pretty expensive kitchen knives. This is the knife that I use more than any other knife for all things meat related, meat and fish. Now, when I get into chopping vegetables and stuff, this is not the right tool. I like more like a Santoku pattern or sort of a chef's knife pattern, some of the straight blade. But for all the deboning, all the trimming, all the fat removal, dealing with fish, all of it, this is the knife. Get it, give it a shot, and you'll see why. It was a top 10 selling item in 2024 and then again in 2025. On T-Spaz. We're talking thousands of these sold through my links. Zero, and I mean zero complaints about the knife, the brand, the company, any of it. Again, Victorinox 6-inch semi-stiff boning knife on sale today at 29% off. With that, let's hear from Dan McAdams and Dr. Ron Paul on the risk of American soldiers' lives and what may be coming next in the Iran conflict in the Persian Gulf.
So the headline is New York Times. It comes from the New York Times. Pentagon considers deploying 82nd Airborne troops for potential attack on Iran's Kharg Island.
Yeah.
That's dangerous. I imagine, this would be my guess, that they don't have the vaguest idea what they'll end up doing.
Yes. I think you're right on that.
And yet, that, just opening up the door to some accident or some false flag or whatever. So this is not good. It is a mess. I say watch out for the danger. And it looks like more and more people are starting to agree with it, even those close to the military trying to get the truth out.
Here's what worries me, Dr. Paul, about this whole idea to send in troops. Well, first of all, we know it's very, very unpopular. I mean, when you ask the Americans at the beginning, well, what do you think about going into this war? Most of them said it's a terrible idea. But then you added on, but what if we had to put in troops? Then pretty much everyone said, terrible, terrible idea. What worries me is that everything about this war seems to feel like it's being done on the fly. Like every morning they wake up, Trump woke up yesterday morning and said, oh my God, what did I do on Sunday? I swore that I would bomb them in 48 hours. So he gets up on Monday and said, just kidding, we're talking to the Iranians. The Iranians say, no, we're not. What are you talking about? And so that was the whole day yesterday taken up by the lie. But, you know, so this was supposed to be a quick decapitation strike. This is how the Mossad sold it to President Trump. We'll take out their leadership. They will capitulate. The people will take to the streets, overthrow their government, put in a friendly government. Everything is hunky-dory. It'll be easy, almost cost-free. Well, that didn't work. And so it became, well, we're going to bomb them until they capitulate. And we did all that. And Trump said, we bombed the blank out of them. That we've already won. It's already over. Well, they bombed back. They took out every single U.S. base. Some are completely out of commission. Some are halfway out. Some are, all of them are seriously damaged. So the retaliation keeps going on. So everything they say that's going to solve this war is actually doing nothing of the sort and making it worse. So when they say, well, we put in 3,000 troops, we're going to take those islands, this will be the plan. This will finally work. Except you're playing with the lives of thousands of American service members.
Yeah, I got to say, I see this happening just about in every libertarian, anarchist, anti-war, and anti-Trump, whether it's left or right anti-Trump corner. And that is, since we are opposed to the war, we have to build a case that we, one, don't know what we're doing, two, we have no objectives, three, our military isn't achieving victory, and four, actually, the Iranians have the tactical advantage. All four of those points, I'm not sorry to say, but I have to tell you, are nonsense. Are absolute nonsense. And it seems like that people are so opposed to the war that what they end up having to do is root against their own country. And I love Dr. Paul, I love Dan, I love Chris. I'm not being overtly critical. I'm telling you, this is a generalized vibe across the board. And I don't believe any of those 4 points for a moment. Not for a moment. Does that mean that we'll get out of this and we'll completely overturn the regime and Iran will end up sending flowers to orphans all around? No, not at all. I think, again, the most likely end scenario in this is a false U.S. declared victory, a withdrawal, a return to stasis, and the real core problem not solved. So I'm not rah-rahing anything. I do understand United States military capability, though. And I think there's a lot of people in denial about what that actually is and what that actually looks like. And no, we don't willy-nilly just throw people around and we don't willy-nilly say we're going to bomb and then not bomb. Now, I do think Trump uses a madman style as being president. Since he says he's going to do all the things and he only does some of the things, you never know which things he's going to do. And I think that is a strategy. And I think that strategy can be traced back with Donald Trump to the 1980s if you read his book, Art of the Deal. This is nothing new. And I have to say it again, this is not a defense of Trump. This is an analysis of fact. Does Trump do shit like this? And does Trump have a track record of doing shit like this before anybody even used the word Trump and run for president in the same sentence? And the answer is yes. So I'm not going to look at that and freak out. I'm also going to tell you this. I don't believe the Iranian regime for a fucking half a second. I don't trust my government, but I really don't trust theirs. Okay? Whatever the number is of my distrust for our government, let's say it's 100, then multiply that by 10,000, and that's how much I trust the Iranian government. When they say, well, we're not talking, bullshit, you're not. Bullshit, you're not. And yes, I have sources that tell me it's bullshit. In fact, the same source being used to say that they're not talking to us, CNN, came out a couple hours after they made that claim and said, well, actually, a senior member of the Iranian government did contact us unsolicited and tell us, yes, that's actually happening. So it's posturing. It's posturing. Now, what do I think happens with this whole sending the 82nd? That's what everybody's talking about, what people are not talking about. And more important to the total calculus, there's a ship called the USS Tripoli, and it contains, among other things, a Marine Expeditionary Unit. And with the ship itself and the other ships with it, it's about 2,500 Marines. And there's another group of MEU, also about 2,500 Marines, so all in 5,000 United States Marines. These are Marines that specialize in things like amphibious assault. But this individual ship, it's like a pocket carrier, you'd call it. It was they only made two of them, and then Congress got in the way and said, don't make these anymore. And it's basically an amphibious support micro carrier, okay, mini carrier, compared to something like the Abraham Lincoln or something like that. And it doesn't have a great big door that dumps down so that all little landing craft can come out of the ship, because it doesn't need to, because we have these things like V-22 Ospreys and Black Hawk helicopters and things like that that can actually put Marines where they need to go. We don't need to put them in a little boat and have them bounce around in the water. Well, that's when they built this ship. The Navy understood that. It got a bunch of bad press, so they canceled this design, but the two of them are out there. What it does is it allows a huge amount of space that was formerly not used. So this little ship, which is little compared to an aircraft carrier that we think of, can carry a squadron of 30 F-35s. 30 F-35s. Let me say it again. 30 F-35s and enough fuel to run them for months. Because they have all the space. Plus a full medical bay and things like that. All in, what do I think's going on? I think, everybody's talking about Karg. Karg is an island, relatively small island, well north in the sea under Iranian control. There's a much bigger island as well, called Kishim. And this is a much larger island, and it is directly on one end, one side of the strait. So this is further south in the ocean, the sea. If I were going to take an island, I would at least consider this. Now, this is a big-ass island. It just doesn't have a huge number of people on it. It does have a lot of military fortification. But if you control that island, you control the strait. There's also quite a few other islands that Iran has technical control over that are very poorly defended that could become U.S. military bases of operation, kind of like a carrier group that's sitting on an island. So we don't have to have a boat move around, much more defensible positions. Those are all possibilities as well. So I predict within the next week or three, some sort of amphibious assault, island taking, possibly even taking a small amount of land on the Iranian coast proper to bring cover. Okay, whether that happens or not, we will see. Because here's the bigger issue in all of this. You have a potential now for Iran to be forced to reveal positions of things they prior to this were just keeping hidden. And what I mean by that is the United States is making a very telegraphed, open, public move here. The Tripoli's been on its way for over 2 weeks now. Okay? So this is not as new as you think it is, along with that other MEU group. The 82nd Airborne stuff has been rattled off by all the wire services. Ever. There's been no attempt at coming at this from a standpoint of, like, surprise the enemy. And you would think that's dumb. That's crazy, Taco Trump, or whatever the fuck. Calm down. No, now Iran must move assets. They can't ignore this because Trump's crazy, so you don't know what he's going to do. For all you know, he's going to invade the mainland. He's going to take Karg and Kishim Islands. You don't know what he's going to do. So now you have to provide defense of these locations. You need to now move Revolutionary Guard. You need to move assets. And we're looking at every square inch of their country 24/7 right now. Using aircraft, using satellite. It's hard for a cat to cross the street and us to not know about it in Iran right now. And what goes on inside a building and all that's different. But when you have to move across terrain right now, even if you're using tunnels, once you pop out, we know. And so the whole thing could be a head fake too. But I just caution everybody. And here, this is why. I oppose all this. I don't want this to happen. We are our side, and we don't need to be doing this, is losing credibility left, right, and center, nonstop, continuously, every time we inflate the capabilities of the Iranian military to something they've never had, let alone they don't have now, or we deflate the capabilities of the U.S. military. I'm sorry. If you are any adversary, the last fucking thing you want to see is a group of American paratroopers backed up by fucking Expeditionary Marines with air cover coming your way. It is a horrifying thing to face. Big part of why we shouldn't be freaking doing it. But what do I know? Let's go on and talk about something better. Hunting Dogs with Joel Riles.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another Expert Council segment. And today we have a question about which breed to choose as a hunting dog. So it's obvious that what they're interested in is some kind of a retrieving dog. But let's start with my basic recommendations for any breed that you might be interested in purchasing. And that is, first decide what you want to do with the dog, and then look at the breeds that are good for doing that thing. So the breeds that they were considering initially were the Labrador Retriever, the German Shorthaired Pointer, and the Wirehair Retrieving Griffin. Now, I'm also going to throw in for your consideration, the Brittany Spaniel, because that's one of Jack's favorite hunting dogs. Now, there are some variations between these breeds, but if you are going to try and make some modifications, meaning you're going to try and train the dog to do a few things that it wasn't specifically bred to do, you want to do that as early as possible. So my recommendation would be to get something like a puppy and then start training all the things you want to do as early in the dog's life as possible. You're going to have the most well-rounded and the most probable situation where you're going to get all the things that you want if you start them young. If you just go off their natural instincts, then you want to be really specific about the breeds that were bred for that specific purpose, all right? So first, the Brittany Spaniel. So they are generally considered a do-everything kind of a hunting dog, and they do have a lot of capability for variations in terms of what they're tracking. I know Jax mentioned that the Brittany he had was great at treeing squirrels, searching out and hunting for various different other types of animals, and also retrieving birds. Now, they were specifically bred as an upland retrieving dog. They're a pretty good pointing dog as well, and they're best suited if you're going to be walking around with your dog, right? And you're not on horseback or something like that. They don't quite have the stamina to run with a horse for long periods of time. So if you're a solo hunter or you're hunting in small groups and you want a dog that's going to stay pretty close to you so you're not running around chasing them all the time or constantly calling them back to you, the Brittany's a really good option for that type of hunting. Now, if you're more interested in doing water retrieving, especially in really cold climates, which is where most of that's occurring, then the Brittany may not be as good an option for that because they're not specifically bred and built for the icy water conditions. Now, a Labrador is probably going to be your top choice in that specific situation, but if you want that capability plus some other things, then we can start looking at the German Shorthaired Pointer as well. Now, your German Shorthaired Pointers are a little bit more high energy, and you can get a variation in your Labradors as well. You can get really high energy working Labradors, which need a lot of discipline in the household if you're going to be living with them. Or you can get some that are slightly lower, but if you want to hunt with your Labrador, you don't want to just get a dog that wants to lay around on the couch all day, right? So, but you also don't necessarily want one that's going to be super, super high energy. I've worked with a couple of Labradors that are as high or higher energy than the Malinois that we breed. So, that's just one thing to keep in mind with them. But they're going to do much better in the water and not quite as good as the other dogs, at least, in some of the more upland or walking around types of retrieving. Now, your German Shorthaired Pointer is generally a much higher energy dog, which is great if you're out doing really long stuff where you're sending them way out, or if you're doing long walks while you're hunting, or if you're on something like a four-wheeler or a horse. Something like that, your German Shorthaired Pointers are going to be great for that. And they can handle the cold water for retrieving in the water as well. And so if you're looking for something that can do both of those, the German Shorthaired Pointer might be a little better. If you're looking for something that's specific to water, your Labrador is probably going to be your best option. And if you want something that's a little bit more methodical, that's going to stay really close to you, the Griffon can be a good choice in that. They also tend to be a little bit more mild-mannered in the home. So if you want a dog that's going to be a little easier to live with and you're not going to have to be on top of them all the time, the Griffon can be a good one for that. Now, overall, especially if water retrieving isn't your primary purpose or you're not going to be doing a ton of that, the Brittany can really be a good option here because they kind of are a little bit of all of the breeds in terms of capabilities. Now, they look a lot different, and again, if you have a specific desire for a look, then as long as that dog is really matching what you're wanting to do with them physically in the field, then you can go with, okay, but I like the look of this one a little bit better, right? And it's not that you shouldn't consider looks of the dog at all. It's just that shouldn't be your primary. Your primary should be, what is this dog bred to do, and is that what I want to do with it? So let's just give a quick recap here. So if you're primarily looking for water retrieving, your Labrador is your best bet. If you're looking for higher energy, going out away from you or running or being on their feet all day long at a really high intensity level, the German Shorthaired Pointer is probably good. If you want something that's really well-rounded and all of that, is going to stay a little bit closer to you as long as you train them properly, is pretty good in the house in terms of manners and not being too overwhelmed with energy, and can do most of the things really well, a Brittany is a really great option. And if you want a slightly lower energy level, a dog that's going to stay closer to you, a dog that's going to be more methodical in its search patterns, then the Griffin is a good choice for that. So depending on specifically what you want to do, I would start with a dog that's bred for that and then narrow it down from there. And the looks of the dog would be my last thing on my list of what am I considering when I'm getting ready to purchase a dog. So I hope that's been really helpful for you. We don't specifically have information on Canine Academy about training hunting dogs, but if you just want to get a really good foundation of obedience, check out canineacademy.us. Go over to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on our banner there so that Jack gets credit if you sign up for one of our courses. We have basic obedience, we have intermediate obedience, and we have advanced obedience that takes you all the way through off-lead obedience with your dogs. Check out those courses if you're interested in getting some training help with your dog. If you're looking for a Malinois, German Shepherd, or Dutch Shepherd, check out FortressK9.com. We have puppies available right now, specifically Dutch Shepherds. We have males and females available. And then we also have fully trained dogs available at the personal protection, family protection, or executive protection levels. So if you're interested in getting a fully trained protection dog, check out FortressK9.com. Click on the consult button there. It'll send me a message, and I'll reach out to you shortly. All right, I hope that's been helpful for you. And remember, until next time, train hard and stay safe.
So I don't want to give too long of an addition to this one, but I just want to say a couple things. One about the Brittany. He's right about why it was bred, but not the whole story, or the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. The Brittany was developed in Brittany, France. It's shocking, right? And it was developed at the time when you and I and normal mortals, muggles, didn't get to hunt. It was the purview of the king and his royalty and the noblemen. And you could be, like, you know, executed for hunting the king's game. Like, you shot a deer or you shot a rabbit and it belonged to the king and you stole from the king and now you're going to die. Like, that was the stakes. And the people of Brittany, France, wanted the ability to hunt anything for the pot. Right? Anything that would feed them. Whether it was a rabbit or a bird or anything. They didn't care. And so the best way I can describe what the Brittany was bred to be is the poacher's dog. And you might not like that term, but that's what it was. And because it was bred as a poacher's dog, it is the closest thing to a do-it-all dog you'll find. Now, the downside of the same is when we talk about like chickens or whatever, like egg layer, meat layer combo. Like the thing that is good at both things is never the best at the one thing. Except with the Brittany compared to the chicken with meat versus eggs, it's a much closer to really good at everything. There's a couple things I would add though. One, yeah, they can get kind of cold. They don't have the body fat. It's not really a fur thing. It's a body fat thing that some of your larger breeds that are good at waterfowl because like fat actually is buoyant. So that's why your labs, right, are so great at that role and what have you. They're also a bit bigger of a dog. They do have more stamina, like Joel said. So I would worry a little bit with cold. I would say that anybody in this day and age that is hunting waterfowl with dogs where the dog is going into the water, please get your dog a flotation aid vest. Please do that. I almost lost my dog. It was a weird situation. We hit a goose. It wing locked. It was really heavy winds. White caps on a dam, and the dog went before we could get him. I don't think he could hear us calling him back, and he got this bird, and he did get back in, and my uncle and I both ended up actually in the water helping the dog out of the water. We were really afraid we were going to lose him, and that just wouldn't have happened if he had had a vest on, right? He would have been much easier for us to get in, and he would have panicked less. We also got the goose. But they're great dogs. My last caution here, and this probably has to do with like activity level, energy levels, everything. I made a huge mistake when I got my dog, even though he ended up being a great dog. There was a kennel called Cushion Peak Pet Kennels up in New Jersey. And this is like when you had to learn things the hard way, like you had to go read magazines and shit to get information. And I researched and found the best championship Brittany's in the country, and they happened to be just right across the state border over New Jersey, and so we went and got one, and his dad's name was Cushion Peak Pat, The kennels were named after him. He had something like 38 blue ribbons, this dog's sire. And his dam, that's the girl dog, she had something like 18. I can remember her name to this day. It was Burke's Ginger. That was her name on her paperwork. And my dog's name was Bushwhacker Britt, because I was a kid and stupid. Anyway, he was hell the first year with the energy level, the running ahead. And then when you learn, well, what were those blue ribbons in field trials? Well, what does the dog judged on in field trials? How many birds can it flush? How fast? Not good. There was a lot of work to it. And I'll give you one little hack on dogs that want to run ahead of you. Two tennis balls on string. If you know what clackers were, right? Where you had the balls and you back and clack, 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 like kind of like clackers. You make them long enough so when you hang them on the back of the dog's collar, those two tennis balls sit right dead center on the rib cage. And when the dog runs, the balls bounce. Boom, 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 boom. Probably for the first half hour, it's just like whatever. And it starts to hurt, kind of like Chinese water torture on the head, right? And the dog slows down. And this worked really well for us with not just Brit, but other dogs that ran ahead. Anyway, good stuff from Joel. And it's probably not, this particular person probably doesn't need a Brittany. They might be better off with another selection, but I always got to throw that one in there because if you want true diversity of capability, I just don't know of a better dog. There really is nothing that can hold its own with a Brittany. If you want an animal that you can put behind a rabbit, you can point a pheasant with, you can hold a grouse on flush, but it will stand in a field with you all day long while you knock doves out of the sky and go get them for you. I just don't know another breed that will consistently do that as well. Anyway, next up, we're talking about power stations and backup power for deep freezers. Really important subject.
Hey, TSP community, this is Ryan Steva with thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today, I've got a question from Wayne, and boiled down, what the question really is he wants a farm sitter proof-ish power backup system for his freezers because of frequent short outages from his power company. He's specifically found the power station EcoFlow Delta 3 Max and wants basically just an extended period of time between when power goes out and when he might need to try to instruct his farm sitter through the process of starting up his propane generator. And so he's got a few things laid out, and he's basically asking, is there a wiser or more resilient architecture or setup than what he's come up with? And basically the short answer is no, Wayne, you've got this pretty much figured out, but there's a few tweaks I would make that I think will make this a bit more resilient. So first of all, he's using two freezers, and he sent me the model numbers, and I estimate these to run at about 350 watts combined. So when they're both running, 350 watts. Typically, deep freezers are going to run for right around 8 hours a day. So Wayne's idea is essentially to take the Delta 3 Max and put it between the grid and the freezers, which will give you some backup time on battery. And the way we're going to run those numbers are we're going to take the 350 running watts of the two devices times 8 hours of running time during a day, which gives us 2,800 watt hours. That's 2,800 watt hours to get your both freezers all the way through 24 hours. The Delta 3 Max is 2,000 watt hours, which Wayne already kind of calculated this, and he was right about it. I'm just going to kind of reiterate that that's only going to get you about 18 hours of runtime. So I would definitely consider getting a larger unit, and I'm going to have a recommendation in a couple of minutes here. There's a couple other things I would recommend. So he already has a monitor that will alert him when, even when power is down, he's got a battery backup for his internet, and he's got a monitor that will alert him if the temperature gets too high in the freezers. What I would add to this is a power monitor, which can be as simple as a smart switch. And so if the smart switch goes out, you know that power is out. The way I would set this up is I would plug one into the wall to grid power and one into one of the extra outlets on the power station. And so if grid power goes out, Wayne will know it because the grid power switch will stop reporting and the backup switch will continue to report. If one of these devices, the UPS devices or power station devices, dies, if that dies on him, then you would see grid power stay on and the unit, the plug on the unit die and or go off. And that's going to give you an indication of, it gives you a lot of troubleshooting capacity from a distance. And that's going to remove the need for the farm sitter to do that troubleshooting for you. It's also going to give you a lot more notification time. So before the temperature goes up on the freezer, you're going to already know that there's a power outage issue on one side or the other. And the last tweak that I would make is suggesting that you consider using a solar panel, because these pre-built devices can use solar input, and a 400 watt panel just sitting up against the south side of a building while you're gone could increase the time that one of these devices, one of these power stations, can get you through from about 18 hours to, potentially several days or maybe even indefinitely, depending on how you set it up. And part of the reason I'm mentioning this is that you don't have to have solar panel mounts. If you're using this primarily when you're gone on vacation, what you can do is you can just set the solar panel out only when you're on vacation, south-facing wall, and just extend the time of the device. And that can really, that can give you a lot more space or leeway for redundancy. It's just a better potential system. Now, for this system, I'm actually not going to recommend any type of do-it-yourself system, because to build something that's the same amount of watt-hour output and has all the features that Wayne is looking for here, I believe a do-it-yourself system would either be complex to put together with fairly marginal parts, or it would cost more. So I'm actually going to recommend just sticking with the pre-built systems. Now, finally, my recommendation on device is because the EcoFlow that you've mentioned only has 400 watts potential of solar input, and it takes really specific panels, and it's also only 2,000 watt hours of battery capacity. There's another really great brand called Pecron. It's kind of like Anker was early on when they were really just a value brand where they sold things for a lot less, but it was still really decent quality. And Pecron is like that. This power station is the F3000 LFP, and I'll send a link for Jack to put in the show notes. And it can take, I believe, up to 1600 watts of power instead of 400 watts of power. It costs the exact same amount as the EcoFlow Delta 3 Max, which is $799. And it has about 50% more battery. So it's a 3000 watt hour battery as well. So it just kind of outshines the EcoFlow in every single way and costs the exact same amount. And so that's what I would recommend as far as devices. All right, so you're hearing it here first. I'm announcing a one-day workshop that I'm doing in Hartsville, Tennessee on April 11th. It's going to be all about do-it-yourself swales on small-scale land. I would love to have you there. We're keeping the price really low because it's my first time doing this, and I expect there's a few kinks to work out, so we're doing it at $50 a head. Lots of space to camp if people want to come in from a ways away. But again, it's April 11th in Hartsville, Tennessee. If you want more information, reach out to me at thehomesteadconsultant@gmail.com. I'd love to answer any questions you have about it. Thanks, everyone.
This is another example of one of those times where I'm like, God, I'm glad that years ago one day I thought, Jack, you maintain a Rolodex of people that you can call up and ask questions about all the things you care about. Your audience needs one of those. Why don't you create one for them? We'll call it an expert panel or expert council. Because some of the nuggets dropped on these shows are just priceless, and they become ingrained things that we use going forward. So the biggest thing I want to talk about is, first of all, when this question came in, I was like, I don't think so. I didn't read it really well. Just that was Ryan's issue. Send it over to him. And my issue was that I had looked into these EcoMaxes in the past, and I'd looked like a big Boss Hog version, and they're like $8,000, and I'm like, man, at $8,000, go get a Generac and a couple hundred pound propane tanks that you can put on a dolly if you don't have natural gas service or whatever, and they'll run for a few days, and they'll run your whole house or most of it. And that can be set up to automatically come on and all that good stuff and what have you. And you're in about the same amount of money, maybe a little bit more. But, well, I didn't realize, like, you know, what he's asking about is like a $1,200 product that you can buy any day of the week for about $800, $750, $800. Because they're always, it's one of those things that's always on sale. So that changes the calculus, and I agree with what he's recommending. But then the big nugget in this one is this Pecron brand. So I looked this product up, and he's right. It's way more performance for the same money. Well, you buy that. The bigger thing is I need to check into this brand because he's also right about Anker. What I always loved about Anker as a value brand is that you were getting premium performance with a company that stands by with a hell of a guarantee for the price of a discount bin product. And Anker hadn't ruined their pricing model at all. They still have a lot of stuff that's really affordable, but it's been creeping up beyond just the inflation affecting all these products, and it has to do with their success. You know, they're in Costco now, just as an example. There's Anker products all over Costco. When I started talking about Anker with y'all years ago, you couldn't get them anywhere but Amazon. So that tells you something about the success track rate. It reminds me of certain brands of wine, okay, like Barefoot, what was the other one? The one out of Australia, I think, Yellowtail. You know, when these wines were released, they were damn good wines, like a Chardonnay. It was $3.99 to $4.99 a bottle, depending on where you bought it. And you stood it up next to, like, not a super high-end wine, but like a something like a Robert Mondavi Coastal Reserve that was $20. And you really kind of were like, I actually kind of like the cheap wine a little bit better. You know, and they're not $30 bottles of wine now, but they're no longer $4 bottles of wine, and they knew what they were doing from the beginning. I think that's what happened with Anker. So, you know, we take advantage of that while we have it in front of us. I'm going to dig in this Pecron. I got a link to the Pecron one that he mentioned in the show notes, but I also noticed you can buy it with a 300-watt plug-and-play solar panel. That's a lot of horsepower for not it's about $1,000 with the panel. Now, it's 300, and he recommended 4, but, I mean, yeah. And you also can order it with two of them. And again, they're designed to be plug and play. That's a pretty good small scale solar powered off grid plus backup system. I mean, a lot of utility there for under $1,500 with two panels in one of these. So I'm going to dig into that more. Now let's talk about something totally different. We've gone from ongoing conflict war to dogs to backup power, and I promise you diversity when we do these shows of topics. Now we're going to go off and talk about Bitcoin nodes using Start9, not only how, but why, with Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today, I have a question from Bob. Bob asks, what's a basic mental checklist I should consider in setting up my own Start9 Bitcoin node? Bob added some details. He's been stacking sats for a while and wants to set up a Bitcoin node to support the network. He is not super tech savvy and is looking at a Start9 server because of the out-of-the-box setup. He also wants to understand the considerations and pitfalls before getting started. Let's start by thinking about why you want to run a node and have realistic expectations about what running a node actually does. Bob mentioned helping the network. A personal node at home will not process the huge transaction volume that large exchanges or infrastructure providers handle. But every node independently verifies the Bitcoin rules and helps propagate blocks and transactions across the network. More independent nodes improve decentralization and make the network more resilient. All the little folks add up. Other folks may have other reasons to run a node. Here are some of them. In addition to helping the network, there's also education. Running a node is one of the best ways to understand how Bitcoin actually works. Instead of relying on someone else's infrastructure, you are directly interacting with the Bitcoin network yourself. For some people, it's about securing their Bitcoin. This point is often misunderstood. Your Bitcoin does not live on your node. It exists on the global Bitcoin ledger that is shared across the network. Running a node does not make your coin safer in the custody sense. Your keys and wallet security still matter. What running your own node does give you is independent verification. When your wallet checks balances or transactions, it can ask your node instead of trusting someone else's server. Others want unstoppable spending. If you do not run your own Bitcoin node, Your wallet usually broadcasts transactions through someone else's node. In practice, that almost always works fine because the network is very open. But theoretically, a node operator could refuse to relay your transaction. If you run your own node, your wallet can broadcast transactions directly to the network without relying on anyone else's infrastructure. Still others are focused on verifying payments. Your node independently validates every block and every transaction. That means when you receive Bitcoin, you do not need to trust a wallet company or Block Explorer or anyone else to tell you that the payment is real. Finally, privacy. When your wallet queries someone else's Bitcoin node for balance or transaction history, you reveal information such as the addresses you're interested in, your IP address, and some information about your device or browser. Running your own node removes the external observer. Your wallet asks your node instead. Now, let's talk through some of the technical decisions you'll need to make. The first decision is pruned node versus archival node. Both types verify every block, verify every transaction, and enforce the same Bitcoin consensus rules. The difference is disk storage. A pruned node deletes older blocks after they are no longer needed for validation. This saves disk space and can reduce storage down to tens of gigabytes. An archival node stores the entire blockchain on disk. My server is using over 700 gigabytes for this and growing every year. If you plan to run additional services such as block explorers or wallet indexers, those typically require the full blockchain. Because of that, many users choose to run a full archival node. Next question, do you want to run an indexing service? If you plan to connect your wallet to your node, the answer is usually yes. Bitcoin Core can validate the blockchain, but it is not optimized for answering questions like, what is the balance of this address? Or what transactions belong to this wallet? Indexers build additional databases that make those queries much faster. Electris is available in the Start9 marketplace and takes just a click to install. Next, a more controversial conversation. Do you run Bitcoin Core or Bitcoin Knots? StartOS supports both, and the decision is entirely up to you. Both enforce the same Bitcoin consensus rules. Both participate in the peer-to-peer network. Bitcoin Core is the older and more widely used implementation. Bitcoin Knots is an alternative implementation that adds additional configuration options and allows users more control over certain relay policies designed to discourage non-monetary data being stored on the blockchain. If you know what you want, just pick it. If you want to learn more, search for Bitcoin Core versus Bitcoin Knots, and you'll find plenty of discussion and opinions. I also covered this in a previous Expert Council segment if you want to go deeper. You will also likely want to add a Block Explorer. You can run a self-hosted version of mempool.space and privately browse all the blocks and transactions on the network, look up addresses and those transactions, and see what's happening in the mempool all within your own server. Two more practical considerations worth mentioning before we get to the steps required to actually set up your own Bitcoin node. Connectivity. Your node will be on and syncing around the clock. If you have a slow or metered internet connection, be aware of that before you start. The initial sync is the most bandwidth intensive part, but the node keeps up with new blocks continuously after that. Power. This will be a device that runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The power draw for most of the servers that you would use is modest, but it is real and ongoing. A UPS, that's an uninterruptible power supply, a battery backup, is worth having. It protects the node from sudden outages and keeps you connected when the power blips. A decent one runs $100 to $200 and can give you hours of runtime. Your router and cable modem should be on it too. So, here's the concrete steps to set up your own Bitcoin node. One, purchase the Start9 hardware you want. Any of their options will handle a Bitcoin node just fine. Size up if you plan on running additional services. Two, plug it into your network at home, then power it on. Follow the initial setup instructions, which will include trusting the server's root certificate. That's just how your browser confirms it's talking to your server and not something else on the network. The Start9 documentation walks you through it clearly. Three, install Bitcoin Core or Knots, your choice. Four, wait for the blockchain to sync. This is called the initial block download, and it can take a day or more depending upon your hardware and internet speed. Be patient, it only happens once. 5, install Electrus as your indexer. Give it some time to index as well. 6, install Mempool for your Block Explorer. 7, connect your wallet to your node. This is the step that ties it all together. Connecting your wallet to your Bitcoin node does not move your Bitcoin onto the node. Your Bitcoin's still on the blockchain. Your wallet still holds your keys. The wallet is just asking your node for blockchain data instead of someone else's server. The specific steps depend on which wallet you use, but Start9's documentation covers the most common options, and it's much less complicated than it sounds. When you're done, you will have a fully synced Bitcoin node, a private window into the blockchain where you can look up any block, transaction, address, and your wallet talking directly to your own server. From that point forward, the node mostly runs quietly in the background, verifying the network and ready whenever you need it. It's a real milestone in your Bitcoin journey, Bob. Enjoy the rabbit hole. This has been Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Thanks for the question. Keep them coming. I love being on the Expert Council and always enjoy questions on Bitcoin, self-hosting, and personal technology.
Good stuff from Jesse. Please remember, if you are looking to pick up Start9 server, it's worth being an MSB member for a loan, because you get 9% off as an MSB member. And I don't think it's still 9%. It might be like 7 now. But you can, if you use a Fold card, you can purchase a gift card from Start9, which will give you more discount cash back in the form of Bitcoin that you can stack on top of the discount code that I'm going to, give you if you're an MSB member. So it's a pretty damn sweet deal. If you're getting a Start9 box, I mean, it's not a Bitcoin box. That's only one thing it does. But most people getting one of those probably are Bitcoin holders. So you probably value Bitcoin. So you can get some Bitcoin cash back. You can get a discount all in one go with Start9. And I had another question come in about Start9 recently that was actually for the Start9 crew. I sent it to Jesse. He's touching base with him. He'll have that answer for you next week or the week after. And with that, let's move on. And let's hear from Mike Melito today on red dot optic magnifiers. Again, you want diversity of topic. Where are you going to get all this in one show? Here, just like you've been doing for years. Here we go. Mike Melito on red dot magnifiers. Are they worth it? Do they work? Are they a scam? Are they a nuisance? Are they useful? And when are they useful, if they're useful?
Hey, TSP. Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast to answer your gun-related questions. I got from Roman what on the surface is a very simple question, but is actually, I think, more about philosophy and trying to find a hardware solution to a software problem, which is trying to buy gear to make yourself a good marksman, which is a deeper issue. So I'm going to answer the simple question, are red dot magnifiers worth it? But yeah, they're not a gimmick. They do what they say they're going to do. They will magnify the size of the target by whatever magnification it is, 2x or 3x or 5x, you know, take your pick. They will do that. So they're not a gimmick. I have done a lot of content on red dot versus LPVO. So red dots with a magnifier have their place. If you're going to shoot the vast majority of the time, 90 plus percent of the time with a simple red dot, you know, dot on target, pull trigger, you know, fast, simple shooting. And every once in a while, like you're going to test new loads with the rifle and you want to see, you know, a small target very precisely to, you know, zero your rifle or try different loads, then you want to put a magnifier, flip it over, or put a magnifier on there. You don't want to have to worry about taking off the optic and re-zeroing it and all that stuff. Or the majority of the time, you're going to have your carbine as a truck gun, and every once in a while, you're going to take it for hunting prairie dogs or coyotes, and you want a little bit more magnification. But most of the time, that's not what you're using it for. Then I think the magnifier makes sense. Other than that, you're probably better off with an LPVO, a low power variable optic, a 1 to something, you know, 1 to 4, 1 to 6, 1 to 8. They even make 1 to 10s now. Here's the thing. A lot of those that say they're a 1X aren't a true 1X, so you got to be mindful of that. But even so, you're generally better off with the LPVO because you're dealing with a simple optic with an etched reticle, which means it doesn't need to take batteries to work, and you're dealing with two lenses instead of four lenses if you have a red dot and a magnifier. You're dealing with a lot more complexity in the system, which in general I like less than a simple system. So if you're going to be doing any significant portion of your shooting with magnification, get an LPVO. That's my opinion. on that both systems work. But I don't think that's what the asker is really wanting here. And I don't know if I want to read the entire synopsis of his. What he's saying is that he's having trouble shooting fast and precisely, and he wants to know if he should get a magnifier. Here's the thing. That's not how that works. If you put a magnifier or get a magnified optic, you are going to be slower. That's how that works. The more you magnify, the slower you're going to be to acquire the target, the slower you're going to shoot. The reason I think I answered a question for you before and told you to get a red dot is you wanted to shoot fast. If you want to shoot fast, the red dot is the fastest system. It doesn't require you to line up sights and then focus and shift your focus from target to front sight. So it's faster that way. Although I love iron sights, the red dots are faster. And unlike an LPVO, which can be almost as fast, it's a lot more forgiving in your eye box. So if you're throwing the gun up quickly or transitioning targets quickly, you don't have to worry so much about your head position, eye position. It's a lot more forgiving it for your eye box than an LPVO or an optic is going to be, especially with magnification. So no, it's not going to make you any faster. It's going to make you slower. That's how magnification on optics works. You're saying you want to shoot really fast and really precise. Yeah, we all do. Shooting fast takes a good shooter. Shooting accurately takes a good shooter. Shooting fast and accurately and being able to balance those two takes a master or an expert shooter. So if you think you're shooting a red dot, but you're going to put a 2x magnifier on there, and you're going to be just as fast and twice as precise, that's not how that works. It takes a fair amount of skill to figure out what distance your target is, what platform you're shooting, how precisely you need to hit that target, and to apply the proper firing solution to that situation. Like, meaning I need this degree of precision and not any more, because any more is going to take me more time and that's not going to matter. Or I need a lot more precision, so I have to take more time. That's how that works. So although your question is, are magnifiers worth it? Well, they can be if you're trying to do what a magnifier will let you do. But for what you're asking, no. I think you just need to practice more. If you want to be better at shooting fast and accurate, you need to practice. You need to train. Now, you may decide later on down the road you want to go with an LPVO or whatever. But if you're shooting any reasonable size target out the, let's say, 300 meters, you probably don't need magnification. You probably just need to focus on the fundamentals. And this doesn't just apply to this question. This applies to shooting in general. I know marketing and people would have you believe if you just buy the next product or the next cool thing, it's going to make you a better marksman, make you a better rifleman or a better pistol shooter. And there's a time for upgrading your kit, but in general, it's not. In general, what you need to do is practice and focus. If you want to be, in this case, faster and more accurate, dry fire, dry fire, dry fire, learn how to call your shots, and learn mounting the gun and doing target transitions properly and ironing out all that superfluous movement. As somebody that does a fair amount of competition, and I don't say this to brag, I say to prove a point, I'm a state pistol champion several times over. Things like man-on-man steel matches and steel challenge, which is basically drag racing with a handgun, shooting as fast as you can from the draw, targets out to 40 yards. The main way you get good at shooting fast and accurate is not trying to go really, really fast. It's ironing out all that superfluous movement and not doing more than you have to get from the gun from where it is to getting a round off and on target. The less you have to do to get that shot executed, the faster you can execute it. So spend the time and training ironing out your shooting technique. And that's probably where you need to focus. Also, you didn't mention this, but just from me reading your, I'm going to call it thesis on shooting, are you shooting with both eyes open? It leads me to believe that you're not. You should be shooting with both eyes open. I don't care if you're shooting a rifle, a pistol, a handgun, a shotgun, with a magnified optic or a non-magnified optic. Learn to shoot with both eyes open, especially if you care anything about speed. That is the proper way to shoot, period. So learn to shoot with both eyes open. If you're not, don't be worrying about getting extra kit. Learn about how to shoot with both eyes open. You're never going to be fast and accurate like you could be if you get rid of a bunch of your peripheral vision by shutting one eye. And you mentioned focus and having trouble with focus. You're probably going to focus a lot better if you use your head the way that it was designed with both eyes open. I'm already running long on this segment. I hope this was helpful. Thanks, Jack. Thanks, TSP, and have a blessed day.
That ending part there about the keep both eyes open, all I can think of is my grandpa's crusty ass voice going, "Keep your both damn eyes open. You watch what you're killing with one eye and you shoot it with the other," or something like that, he used to say. I never had the problem, though, because being blind in one eye, I don't bother closing it. So it's kind of like the best of both worlds, I guess. I get to keep my eyes open, so it looks like I'm doing it right, and I get the whatever benefit there is by closing an eye. I can't tell you the difference because I've never seen out of my left eye in my life enough for it to matter. Anyway, with that, let's move on. We're going to talk now about, again, like we're talking about diversity today. Like we're going all over the map here, but all things for self-sufficiency, self-reliance, independence, liberty, lifestyle design. We're talking about a tax situation now. And in this case, Matt Sersley is going to answer a question about this guy has a fairly successful microgreens business. He did about $86,000 in gross sales a year last year. He wants to know, should I file a Schedule C like I've been doing, or is there an advantage to filing a Schedule F with a specifically for farms? I'll let Matt explain it, and then I'll tell you one reason you might want to consider the Schedule F, or you may not even want to think about it, depending on what you might be doing next in your journey.
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley, AgoristTaxAdvice.com, here to answer another listener question. Question. I have a microgreens business supplying local restaurants and health food stores started in 2020. I am currently an LLC. I have heard other farmers talk about filing a Schedule F for their business, but I'd like to know the actual business advantages or disadvantages of doing so. Some additional details. My gross revenue in 2025 was $86,000 and has been growing consistently about 30% per year. So Schedule F is not automatically better than Schedule C. There are just different ways to report income. Schedule C is kind of the traditional sole proprietor business, while Schedule F is set up specifically for farms. For a microgreen business, you really could argue either way, kind of depending on how your business operates. So for Schedule F, you need to be growing a product you sell, and that's obviously what you're doing. The IRS definition of farming is very, very broad. It covers cultivating, operating, or managing a farm for profit, and that includes any crop production. So even in plastic growing trays, that is cultivation. You could call yourself a farm. On the other hand, if your business looks and feels more like a specialty food business or a local supplier or a production and distribution business, then Schedule C is a very defensible position. With something about like microgreens instead of, you know, carrots or lettuce, you're not a traditional row crop operation, so there's some gray area. Now, some businesses don't have a choice. If you are growing potatoes in the ground, you are a farm. If you are selling, you know, widgets on e-commerce, you are Schedule C. But there are some businesses that can really argue to be either way. So this is not about really is one of these right or wrong. It's about which are you closer to and the trade-offs. Now let's talk about the trade-offs. Schedule C is simpler. More CPAs are going to be familiar with it. More CPAs are going to be comfortable helping you with it. It tends to fit neatly into the way more people think about how a small LLC operates. Practically speaking, you know, there's not going to be as many discussions about is this a hobby or is this a hobby farm as is this a business. You know, farms, especially if you're losing money on paper, even as you're grossing that much, you can lose your business deductions very easily. As a Schedule C, they can still declare you to be a hobby, but it's going to be a little bit less likely to happen. It's going to be a little harder for that to happen. So especially if you're barely profitable on paper, Schedule C might be a much better plan. Now, Schedule F has one major advantage, and that is that there's an additional schedule you can use called Schedule J, and I'm sorry for throwing all these letters around, but these are what the forms are called. Schedule J is pretty cool because you can actually average your income over the past 3 years when you file your taxes instead of using just this year's. And where that's really useful is as you have a growing business like you do, you're growing 30% per year,
that will lower your current tax bill because you made more this year than you did the year before and the year before that. This is a thing put in place to help farms that sometimes you have a bumper crop and sometimes you have a failed harvest. This way, the amount of taxes you owe is kind of on a more even keel. Now, the other thing to think about is maybe you shouldn't be either one of them. Depending on how profitable you are, it might be time to start talking about becoming an S-Corp. Because whether you're Schedule C or Schedule F, you're paying self-employment taxes of 15.3% on every penny of profit. That's in addition to your income taxes. As an S-Corp, and this is why people love S-Corps, as an S-Corp, you can potentially avoid some of that 15.3% tax. You know, let's say you're making $50,000 a year in net profit. Maybe you pay yourself $30,000 as a wage. You take $20,000 as profits. You don't pay that 15.3% on that $20,000. You just save $3,000 as an S-Corp. Now, the downside of an S-Corp is it's way more finicky. The details matter a lot more. The tracking and documentation matter more. And it is a more complicated tax form to file that most people charge more to do. So kind of at that $50,000 net profit is where that line tends to get drawn. And there's other considerations. So don't, again, I'm not telling you to do a Schedule C or F or be an S-Corp here. I'm saying, you know, a lot more information is necessary to know what's the best thing for you. You know, and you mentioned you're an LLC. I do just want to throw out that doesn't matter. You could be an LLC or not. You could still do Schedule C or Schedule F. You do need an LLC or a corporation to be taxed as an S-Corp, so that's an option for you. But if you're a listener out there who's in a similar situation without an LLC, setting up an LLC is very, very simple. So my answer is, based on what I know about your business, which is not a whole lot, yeah, you could be Schedule F, you could be Schedule C. Schedule C is going to be simpler and a little bit cheaper and maybe a little bit safer if you're not very profitable. Schedule F opens up the farm income averaging. And again, once you're really profitable, you know, it doesn't make sense when it's $10,000 a year profit. But when you, if you're really making money on this, definitely considering going to an S-Corp is what you should consider doing. Well, thank you so much for listening to me. Please reach out to me at agoristtaxadvice.com/TSP to schedule the free phone call with me if you're interested in working with me. Bye.
That was perfect. There's nothing I can add to it in all the aspects of what he covered, except if I was discussing this with the person that asked the question from a consulting standpoint, I would have one more question for them. Do you plan to expand agricultural activities in the future to more of a true farm situation where you would be doing things that might benefit from receiving an agricultural loan? As in, you need to borrow money because you're actually breaking ground and going into more of a true farm situation, and you want to be able to get a line of credit to do that, which might even include something like buying a house that is already zoned agricultural, and you can actually roll the whole loan into that and not only having strong income, but having 3 years of Schedule Fs that show profitable farm business, and they don't give a damn what kind of farm, is how you really make sure you can get those kinds of loans. So if you are thinking at some point, I might want to expand, I might want to help fund things like high tunnels in conjunction with, you know, NRCS grants, and then I got to pay the difference, but now I can borrow the money, super great interest rates, relatively easy loan to acquire, as long as you can show that income is justified and the business plan fits, but you're going to need, in fact, this is, you know, when you're trying to get an agricultural loan, you really want to have that Schedule F, profit of loss from farming. It's standard. Lenders, especially the USDA Farm Service Agency, or FSA, use this to verify your farming history, experience, and income. And that is a bureaucrat that doesn't know anything about farming making that decision. They just know there's a Schedule F, there's a list of expenses, a list of revenue, and you pay tax on it. That's all they know. So that would be something you might want to consider. All right, now I want to read my question that I smell a little Alex Jones on this, and I understand that it might be somebody else. This might be a YouTube video or something like that. Let me read it, and then I'm going to give you my answer to it. Oliver says, how to prepare for and manage a government confiscation of your preps. I wanted to ask you and your experts for perspective on a difficult topic. So I'll start off with right now, Oliver. This is not a difficult topic. This is a topic that's driven more by fear than reality. I'm going to keep reading. What to do if the government goes after people's supplies and firearms? I'm trying to mentally prepare for this kind of situation so I can make thoughtful, deliberate decisions if it ever arises. Now, he's not talking about the government kicking in doors and seizing guns under some sort of a gun ban. He's talking about shit at the fan. So understand as I'm answering this. My current thinking is that directly resisting officers who come to take supplies may not be the right course of action. Boy, howdy, are you right about that. In my view, staying calm-focused and relying on prior preparation can lead to a better outcome overall and stay on top of the situation. I realize this is a complex and somewhat contradictory subject. It's only contradictory because somebody scared you. Which is exactly why I really value your insight. I'm about to give it to you. Looking forward to hearing from you. Best regards, Oliver. Now, I want everybody to understand, I'm not picking on Oliver at all here. I want to tell you that I think the main source of all the angst like this, and this is not the first time I've gotten this question, it's not the first time I answered it, I'm sure it won't be the last. Okay? I just get a lot less of them today than I did during the heyday of everybody freaking out about, like, 2012 and shit like that. First and foremost, I believe this really does come from the Alex Jones type, oh, they're going to get you, they'll make you shit on the blue line or the red line and put you on the train and go to the FEMA camps, right? Like that shit. And then tons of people that are content creators on YouTube, etc., and they're just begging for eyeballs and ears. They just need somebody to pay attention, somebody click the like, somebody subscribe, somebody leave a content, doesn't matter, I just want pay attention to me, okay? And you run out of shit to talk about if you stay too tight in your typecasting. That's why even though we're the survival podcast, this week we learned about things like leadership and how to use AI, right? Because we're about lifestyle design as a whole, because if you're going to be prepared, you not used to be prepared for shit to go wrong, but prepared to thrive in life, and then you have the redundancies in place, and you get knocked off of that plan, it's not a catastrophe, it's just an inconvenience. So we have so much to talk about, we don't need to hype anything. See how that works? And so I think most of this is just hype. People that need something to talk about. Now, what legal framework is there for this? Because there is some. Legal authority, the Defense Production Act of 1950 authorizes the government to prevent hoarding and seize items beyond reasonable personal use. It's very subjective, and I can see why people would get nervous reading that, okay? Executive Order 13603 provides authority for the government to take control of food, water, energy, and transportation resources during a crisis. Key in on the word resources and think like a government person or think like a criminal. Where are you going to go? Where there's lots of stuff, right? Okay. Historical precedent. During crises like Hurricane Katrina, law enforcement engaged in door-to-door confiscation of items, including firearms. Law enforcement did not take anybody's fucking food. The only thing they fucking took was firearms, and it's because retards were sent down to Louisiana that didn't know Louisiana law. That's why. Because there was so much trouble, they took cops from anywhere they would volunteer and set them loose in Louisiana, and a lot of those cops were from places like Connecticut and didn't know what the fuck they were doing, and were violating both U.S. and Louisiana law when they took those weapons. So that is a one-off type thing. That was about people shooting at each other. That's not what we're really asking about here. Resource allocation. A major collapse, government efforts may focus on securing massive commercial warehouses, but localized compensation could still occur. Now, I want you to think about this. You are, I don't even know, you're freaking Dallas County Commissioner and the mayor and all, working with the National Guard and FEMA during some sort of grid down major collapse where we need to take control of resources. Where are you going to go? Where are you going to go? Are you going to go online and find Oliver and Oliver's house and go to Oliver's house and take Oliver's shit? So that you can feed people that are like Oliver with the shit? You're going to go door to door saying, hey, do you have more than two loaves of bread? Or would you go to, like, take over, like, the warehouse stores first? And the warehouses that supply the warehouse stores first. And the logistics companies that have the trucks that roll in and out constantly that warehouse things for warehouses. Where would you, if you're a hacker, do you want to hack Oliver's computer or Jack's computer? Or do you want to freaking break into the freaking VA benefits database and get the information on every veteran that the VA has? Which one is more useful? Which one is more valuable? This is just not reality. Okay? And if it was, what are you going to do? Not prep? Not prep? I just, fuck it, I'm not going to, because they're going to come take it anyway. Like, this is the thing, like, I'm not saying this can't happen. I'm also not saying that someday a giant comet might not smash into the Earth and make what happened to the dinosaurs look like a day at Disneyland and we'll all be dead. I am telling you that even though that has a possibility of occurring, it's way down on my list of things that I worry about. And it should be for you too. You are way more likely to get run over by a school bus today, even if you don't leave your house, than to get hit by a comet. Or to have the government show up and take away your extra loaf of Wonder Bread. So, I don't know, maybe if what you're doing is really, really obvious, you have a really, really large amount of stuff, I would worry, but I'm going to tell you that, you know, I guarantee you for most people that even call themselves preppers, the average small grocery store has 1,000 times more than they do. They're all going to get wiped out. Not if they... What, are you understanding that there's a supply chain situation going on here? That's actually where you grab onto the supplies. And what would be the purpose of this? To starve us all out and kill us when the blue helmets come? Or because the government's trying to keep people alive? Now, I don't trust them. You know me. I don't trust them at all. But in the end, it's kind of what they try to do in a disaster. They're just not very good at it. So what you need is lots of stuff. And then what you want to be able to do is control the distribution thereof. But if we look back in history, literally the only thing close to this that we can point to, because I did deep research into this to try to find out, well, what's happened, when, and where, the only time this has happened at the front door of individuals' houses, outside of commercial exchange situations, is Katrina. It was never people going in and saying, hey, you have too much rice. It was overzealous law enforcement that was trying to deal with a problem the way that they deal with it back where they were from, which is when people are shooting each other, you take everybody's guns away because nobody's supposed to have a gun anyway. And I understand Louisiana, like, yeah, that's not how that works here, Tex. And that was actually found to be unconstitutional. And I believe, you know, with a few exceptions, of course, that pretty much everybody was given their property back. Again, this is not me trusting government. This is me trusting, not even trusting. This is me being pragmatic about what you call risk assessment. Where are my risks at? What is the probability of anything that I'm preparing for? Because I find most people that ask this question, if I said, if I went to your house right now and just cut off your power and cut off your water and said, you can do whatever you want on your property, but you can't leave it for 30 days, that they would be just fine. Because most of those people would say, well, yeah, I would, but when you start, well, let's talk about it. Well, how would that work? What does that look like? Have you figured out what you really have, what you really don't? How would you keep all that food in your freezer from going bad? You can do like Patriots to come and collapse, take it all out and jerk it, right? You know? or like, are we misleading ourselves here? And they say, okay, could you go 60 days? And if you can't answer both of those with a yes, honestly, do you think you're the storehouse that the government can rely on to go take all your stuff? I mean, I don't know. Maybe if you were featured on that stupid survival show they tried to get me to go on, I told them to go get bent that Nat Geo ran years ago or something, and you have a video out. I mean, and still, see, here's the problem. We have people that have this bipolar view of government. It is both completely incompetent and hyper-competent at the same time. Those two things cannot be true. It is ridiculously incompetent and still capable of many things. That's what, where you're really at with government. You think the government has the ability to figure out, you know, kind of like an island hopping, homestead to where go get all the shit? And do you think that's a profitable, and I don't mean monetary, but from a standpoint of energy invested versus what's taken out, enterprise for the government to do in the middle of a crisis when most of them are probably worried about surviving themselves? And what are the odds of a crisis this big in the first place? Pretty low. So I'll tell you what, Oliver, and anybody else in this situation, you can worry about this. When you get into a position where the world could go away for 90 days and you'd have no worries whatsoever. Because that's not even that likely to be necessary. That's why we train people, first get ready for 30 days, based on the region you live in and the primary things that are a threat where you are. And if you do that, you're probably going to be fine anyway. And then if you can extend out the monetary supply, in other words, have a reserve emergency cash flow of at least 90 days, and then slowly over time with your supplies and all your preps and your production and everything go from 30 to 60, and you got 60 days of stuff and 90 days of income, you can pretty much go on with building the rest of your life. If times get tougher, even if they don't. It's almost like we knew what we were doing when we started this thing all the way back in 2008. Anyway, and by the way, there were people asking this question, Oliver, and everybody else out there, as though it was going to happen tomorrow morning in 2008 when I started the show. That was 17, almost 18 years ago. 17 years and a few months. And we're still here. We even had a global pandemic. We're still here. Don't come at any of the stuff that we talk about from a place of fear. Come at it from a place of power and confidence and building things for the future, not hiding things in case the future is dark. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean to be dumb about what you do. It doesn't mean to advertise and tell all your neighbors you're the prepper on the block or anything. Right? And you preps, don't go panic buying and getting 15 cases of MREs or some shit. Just do what we teach. Follow the basics. Go to the website, thesurvivalpodcast.com. Go to the About tab. And then under the About tab, you're going to find articles. And when you find articles, under articles, you're going to find modern survival philosophy. It's 12 tenets of modern survivalism. That's the approach to take. And I wrote that article in, you guessed it, 2008, and it's still there, and it's still probably the best list of things that you can do to put your house in order. And there's also some, there's some presentations I've done going through the 12 tenets of modern survivalism. With that, I'm ready to wrap up. Again, usually when I'm wrapping up one of these shows, it's the end of the week, and I'm saying, have a great weekend, but tomorrow I will be back live, 11:30 a.m. Central Standard Time. I and Mike Melito from Good Shepherd Training will go live. We'll talking about guns and firearms from the practical to the tactical and everything in between. So tune in for that. I'll catch you tomorrow. And remember, you can always help support our show by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z. tspaz.com. Again, we've got the Victorinox 6-inch semi-stiff boning knife listed today. Pick one up. You will not regret it. They're under $30 on sale right now, 29% off. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with another show. The American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.